welcome to the 2024 Iowa City Book Festival, presented by Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature. We would like to thank the sponsors and partners that made this event possible: the City of Iowa City, the University of Iowa, the Iowa City Public Library, Prairie Lights, Iowa Public Radio, the Graduate Hotel, and Think Iowa City. Support is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Iowa Arts Council, which exists within the Iowa Economic Development Authority. Between events, be sure to visit the book fair at Merge, which is located at 136 South Dubuque Street, right next door to the public library on the Ped Mall. The vast majority of the book festival events are offered without charge, but they are not free. Please consider donating to the City of Literature by visiting iowacitybookfestival.org and clicking on support. Today, we are at the panel discussion, Who Do You Read? In this panel, writers will discuss some of their favorite writing by others, sharing the things they like to read and important books they would like to recommend. Now, please welcome our moderator, Jenny Colville.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. I'm just going to start off by introducing our panelists. So we have Nicholas Medina Mora here. He was born and raised in Mexico City. He has degrees from Yale University and the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, and has worked in New York City as a journalist at Reuters and BuzzFeed. His debut novel, America del Norte, I just read a really nice review of it in the New York Times. It's great. And he currently lives in Mexico City, where he is a writer and editor for Revista Nexos. Chris, I'm going to, you just told me how to say your name, and I'm going to butcher it now.
It's Chris Tace.
Chris Tace, thank you. A poet, editor, and nonfiction writer from New Zealand. He's the author of poetry collections, How to Be Dead in a Year of Snakes, He's So Mask, The Supermodel Minority, the latter of which was a finalist for the 2023 Lambda Literary Awards for Gay Poetry. He's a current New Zealand Poet Laureate and a fall writer in residence for the International Writing Program. Sharon Wall is a writer and documentary film producer. Her collection of love stories inspired by classic philosophy texts, Everything Flirts, won the John Simon Short Fiction Award and was published by the University of Iowa Press in the fall. She's currently writing Bitter Tales, a collection of flash fiction and essays. And then we have Nicholas Wong, a poet, translator, and visual artist from Hong Kong. He's the author of Crevice, or Crevasse, I'm not sure.
I think it's either way, I don't know.
Either way, okay. which won the Lambda Literary Award for Gay Poetry, and Besiege Me, which was a finalist for the same award. He's also the winner of the Australian Book Review's Peter Porter Poetry Prize in 2018. He currently teaches at the Education University of Hong Kong, and he is also a fall 2024 writer in residence in the International Writing Program. And then finally, we have Peter Zavada, a poet, playwright, translator, and teacher from Hungary. He's the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Wreck in Lee, in addition to four other books of poetry. Several of his plays have been produced to acclaim in Budapest, Nitra, and Dresden, and the Koretz Street Shakespeare Car Wash won the Critics' Choice Award for the Best Hungarian Theater Production of the Year in 2021. Zavada is a fall 2024 writer in residence at the International Writing Program. I guess I'll just start off with the question that you all are here for. I think that as writers, it's sometimes important to have those other writers in our life that we have felt a strong kinship toward and almost become a little bit, I don't know, for me, like family. You follow them, their career, you get excited about their next book, you feel like they're teaching you things. So I'm wondering, who are those writers for you all? And they can be from your country or not. And would you like to start since you're right there?
Sure. Okay, so let's, assuming that we're talking about like living writers who are working right now, I think the one that I am, that I admire the most and I'm most excited about is the Mexican novelist and journalist Fernanda Melchor, the author of Hurricane Season, which was translated brilliantly by Sophie Hughes and published by New Directions a few years ago. I think it's the most important novel written in Mexico since possibly Juan Rulfo's Pedro Páramo in the mid-20th century. Melchor is a crime reporter by trade, and what's amazing about her books is that she's the sort of writer who has spent enough time listening to people with a tape recorder, so she can like reproduce the way that people actually speak. But she inserts this, this sort of like real, realistic, almost like ethnographic accounts of like language, of Mexican, different ways of Mexican, of speaking Mexican Spanish. She integrates it into this kind of like neo-Baroque syntax where very slangy terms coexist with very bookish and very sort of elevated diction. And I think that's incredible. And it's new, it feels new. And it feels like we're witnessing, you know, the emergence of a writer that we're gonna continue to read in 100 years. And so I read everything she publishes. And I am very much looking forward to her new books, right? Like her latest is Paradise, which is a shorter novel that is sort of like a rewriting of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, except that it takes place in like the Mexican Gulf Coast. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's this thing where, you know, you can't even be jealous of her, right? Because she's a genius, like an actual genius, right? It's sort of like Fernanda Melchor. M-L-C-H-O-R. But yeah, it's, you can't be jealous of Leonardo da Vinci, right? And you can't be jealous of Fernanda Melchor. You just bow down and say like, yes, you know, thank you for deigning to like share your books with us mortals. So yeah, that's somebody I read everything she writes.
That's wonderful. Yeah, we can just go down the line or can jump.
First of all, thank you for having me and sorry for being a little late. It's not a thing that I usually do. If we're talking living authors who inspire us, and it is very important. Thank you. I would most definitely say Ben Lerner, who inspires me deeply, and Carson. So just to name a. Two authors that are really, really important to me, that they actually changed the way I write today. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in genius, so I don't want to bow down. I want to follow in their footsteps in as much as, you know, making my own decisions as a writer and finding my own voice as a writer, but at the same time being inspired by these amazing figures of contemporary literature. So so Ben Lerner just came out with a poetry collection entitled The Light, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. It was published in 2023. And it's a bit different from his previous work, because his previous work was really, we usually say that he's inspired by the New York School of Poets, and that he's really a student of Ashbery's, of John Ashbery's, and that's why he's using the collage like nature of language and sentences or syntax that he just picks up, I don't know, like on the street and overhears from the TV and from radio and from other people's conversations, and mixed with highly intellectual philosophical texts, just as you mentioned. I mean it has been mentioned that everything can inspire us, and this could be like juxtaposed in one text, and that's what really I think what describes the sort of world that we're living in right now, that everything is on display, simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And that's what really inspires me, because I used to try to write in in a certain style, and then I changed up my style, and then I wrote another style, and then I realized that I don't have to change between these styles because they all exist at once, right, mm-hmm. simultaneously. And that's what was proven to me by John Ashbery's poetry, and then also by Ben Lerner's. But what's really interesting is that Ben Lerner did take a more personal turn in his recent book, which draws on his duties as a father, you know, what can he tell his children, what he cannot tell his children, can he, yeah, so it's, it, I think this is a significant turn in his poetics, in his poetry, that he did finally take up some more personal matters. Okay, so.
I also am a huge, huge Ann Carson fan. When I was first told about this panel, I actually got a different set of descriptors of it from what it currently says. It didn't say to tell people about great books that you might want to recommend. And what it actually said in my, maybe I just got this myself, but what actually, can you hear me first of all? Is this on? Okay. What it said was, has a writer or a particular text been an igniting experience for you? And so that's what I decide to seize the moment to write a little thing about. I remember the exact moment I learned to read. I was 6 years old. There was a shelf of small green paperbacks that the teacher had assigned to us to read our way through, at our own pace, as she put it. I sat at my desk and turned the pages of each little green book at a pace determined by the page turning of the girl sitting next to me. The girl finished her book and walked over to the shelf to get the next one. I followed her, a respectful 2 minutes later. I picked up another small green book and flipped through the pages. And suddenly there were words. For the first time, the random marks on the page were words. To say that hearing Donald Barthelme's story at the end of the mechanical age read aloud on the radio had the same effect on me when I was 32 would probably be an exaggeration. But it might not be. It might be true. This was in Berkeley in 1989. The radio program was Selected Shorts. Turning on the radio and expecting jazz, I heard a beautiful deep voice speaking sentences so strange I stopped everything. God was standing in the basement reading the meters to see how much electricity had been used up in the month of June. Grace is electricity, science has found. It is not like electricity, it is electricity. And God was down in the basement reading the meters in his blue jumpsuit with a flashlight stuck in the back pocket. I thought to myself, if this guy wrote this story and this guy has this voice, I'm going to give up. At that point, I too was a writer, a late starter, as I am at all things, it turns out. This is because I love too many things. I wanted to be an astronomer, a pianist, a computer scientist, a mathematician, and then I started writing. But I didn't know what to write about. I read The New Yorker while sitting in doctor's offices. There were stories about people worrying that they'd never told their mother they loved her. Those were not my stories. I didn't know how to find my stories. And then I heard Roscoe Lee Brown reading Donald Barthelme. And yes, the author himself was not, in fact, reading this story. It was an actor in possession of a magnificent voice, so I wasn't, after all, required to immediately give up. Mm-hmm. But what was the story about? How did it work? There's nothing I'd call a plot, though things happen. The characters meet in a grocery store when the narrator can't figure out what brand of soap to buy. I couldn't decide, so I closed my eyes and reached out blindly. And when I opened my eyes, I found her hand in mine. God shows up. Within a few pages, the characters marry, divorce, and have a child. The child is sent off to that part of Russia where people live to be 110 years old. You can write about anything, was my reaction, though that might not be true, or at least it remains to be demonstrated. After this, I wrote my own versions of stories about anything. And my rejections became much more interesting. From an editor at Bantam Doubleday, Dell, is this a story? Is it science fiction? I'm not sure on either count. J.D. McClatchy at the Yale Review wrote, to tell you the truth, this story, I'm told, fell behind my associate editor's desk at home and stayed there for some weeks. I saved these old rejections because they were so beautiful, typed out on press letterheads, on textured papers. In those days, editors told you stories. They gave you advice. Lots of advice.
Wow.
You felt respected as you were being rejected.
Yeah.
Naturally, I decided that I had to find Donald Barthelme and study with him. But by then, he was dead. He died in July 1989, just a few months after I learned of his existence. A couple years later in Oregon, I met Tracy Dougherty, who had studied with Barthelme in Houston. I asked him way too many questions. Finally, he told me about a time when he had terrible writer's block and he went to Barthelme for advice. This is the story he told me. Barthelme instructed him to buy 3 bottles of wine. 1, prepare for the night of writing by drinking the first bottle of wine. 2, drink the second bottle of wine while staying up all night writing. 3, I've forgotten the instructions for the third bottle, as one would if one had followed the instructions for the first 2 bottles. That is sort of literally true, even though it's ridiculous here. It is true that my writing opened up in a mysterious way.
Yeah.
And my rejections did get much better after hearing that story read on the radio.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
I was in an interesting position in the past year and a bit because I was asked to edit Best New Zealand Poems 2023. So I read every single New Zealand poetry book published in 2023, as well as every poem written by New Zealander published in journals and magazines. So I spent a year reading nothing but New Zealand poetry. But I found that to be a really wonderful experience because I guess as poet laureate, you know, people expect you to have opinions about poetry and to know what's happening. And it was really a great sort of like insight into what's happening in New Zealand poetry and who is writing and who I should be reading. So there were a lot of poets that had never been on my radar before. So I found that exercise in itself, reading this amazing group of poets has been such a huge inspiration for me and has actually sort of opened my mind and changed my relationship to poetry, especially in the past year. But if I were to single out 2 writers who have had a big influence on me as a writer, there's Jenny Bornholt, who is a New Zealand poet, national treasure. She also former poet laureate, but has this wonderful ability to capture, the domestic life, but really sort of blow it up into a macro perspective and really, identify those big ideas in just the smallest of things. And the other poet that I'll mention is Alex Dimitrov, an American poet who writes so tenderly about, I guess, the contemporary queer experience. And also just takes the smallest of moments, like having a smoke on a balcony at a party, and just turning that into like this biggest meaning of life moment. And that's what I love so much about poetry, about being able to juxtapose those two experiences. Yeah.
I think before I tell you guys, who I read or read, I have to do a little bit of introduction about my background, and that has something to do with, why I read or read these people at different stages in my writing career. So I'm from Hong Kong, and I write my poetry in my second language, in English. So when I did my MFA, I was taught these, canonical American poets. And then I started doing research online, and then I started seeing names repeatedly published in American magazines and journals. And I thought, so these are the peoples I should read. And then, of course, those are Asian American poets, the younger generations. So I was reading a lot of them in different magazines and books, and getting things online myself. And then afterwards, I was a little bit bored by the whole trope of Asianness, the representation of Asianness, a diasporic Asian American poets because I'm obviously not one of them. Right. So I'm trying to navigate a way to write about myself after learning the syntax, the diction, the rhythm, you know, the trope, you know, and things like that. So I discovered John Yao and also Timothy Liu. And I realized, I mean, of course, you know, these people are from, you know, previous generations, from the current, you know, the younger ones. But then I realized that there's something very captivating in the poetry about life and art, in John Yao's case, and also being gay as a Chinese American, in Tim Liu's book as well. And he's also very playful, and, you know, his poems can be erotic, but with craft. That's what I appreciate about his poems. And afterwards, I stopped reading a little bit for some reasons, and then I turned to artists' writing instead of like poetry. I found the writing of the American artist Ronnie Horne's writing stimulating. She has this book about Iceland. The book is called Island Zombie, and it's very it's an existential collection of travel essays about, you know, hot springs in Iceland. I just love that a lot. You can read that in one sitting. It's not really long essays. You can also take the small chapters as like prose poems or lyric essays as well. So, and recently I resumed reading after I arrived, you know, in Iowa, and then I realized that I've been following names because there are these there are poets that I keep returning to, repeatedly, in different stages of my life, and these are the names. If you want the names, they are Ray Ammatrout, Brenda Human, Brian Tier, Mary Ruffo, and Eileen Miles. Mm-hmm. So these people have different treatments about the language. You know, they familiarize the language significantly in their work, and they always play with fragments as well. This is, you know, what I think is interesting to me, to get, you know, to tune myself back into the you know, how the syntax and rhythm works in the Anglophone language. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wonderful. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, there were two questions floating around here. One, you know, who. What writers are, do we think are important from our cultures, who, you know, the rest of the world needs to know about, and but also those might not be the same as writers who are super important in an intimate way for you, that teach you things. But I think we got kind of a good variety of responses there. Yeah, one thing I noticed is kind of the interdisciplinary mentions of writers working in different genres, and and that I just wanted to extend that question a little bit further. It seems like there's a new sort of taking on, like, in the literary world of writing that comes from all these different directions, and you know, with the nonfiction and within a novel structure, or writing about art, ekphrasis, and you guys are all. I know one of you is an art visual artist, and one is Eric, or no, it's one of.
Nicholas.
Oh, so sorry. and a film, a filmmaker, and a journalist, and theater, a person, and I saw spoken word in your bio too. But I wonder how these other genres inform your work, and if there are people in these different, not just genres, but other. Artists out there working in different modes that are inspiring to you right now.
Should we go again?
Sure. Yeah. Or you guys can just like jump in. You know, if you want to like connect to what someone else is saying, that's fine too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think like so there's like this question of like interdisciplinarity or of you know, of like transgenre works and whatnot. I actually have come to conclude that. Like genres don't exist, right? Or like they are useful maybe as like heuristic categories. Think about the history of literature, But, you know, I don't really think that there's like a big distinction between, say, you know, theater and poetry, or for that matter, fiction and nonfiction. I think that like one of the things that I am very grateful for my time in the nonfiction writing program is the discovery that essays can include things that are not just facts, right? And vice versa, novels can include facts. Novels can include history, novels can include journalism, and that's in the end why I wound up becoming a novelist. I came to Iowa as a journalist. I had been doing like pretty sort of like, you know, by the book, honest to God reporting. And then I showed up here and I was attracted to the program precisely because of this notion that actually you can pretty much do whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
And then when I returned to Mexico, what I realized is that like everybody does everything, right? There is no division of labor between literary critics and like reporters or like political essayists and poets, right? Like people care about the political opinions of poets, right? Even if they don't read their books. And I think that for me is inseparable also from something that Nicolas Wong was saying, my namesake, because I am also an exophonic writer, right? I also write in a language that is not my mother tongue. I also write in Spanish a great deal, but in Spanish I'm mostly a political essayist and a reporter. But I am very happy that I get to write my, so to speak, my literature in English, because it's almost like writing in a dead language at this point. It's wonderful because there's an estrangement that happens when you encounter, when you write in a language that is not the one that you are most comfortable in, that confronts you with language as language. And for me, that's inseparable from this interdisciplinary thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just about writing in different genres or like taking inspiration from people who are writing different things than the ones you're writing. It's also about writing and reading in different languages as well, right? I think that I am very committed to this notion of world literature, not in the sense of kind of like, you know, like world music or like, you know, exoticizing things, but like I think that it's important to know what, you know, what are they writing in France? What are they writing in Russia, right? Like, what are they writing in different parts of Latin America? Mm-hmm. And whenever possible, to read in those languages. And I think that that for me is a different kind of interdisciplinarity, right? But yeah, I don't know. It's like, I don't really think that we should be that concerned about like divisions of genre. I don't think that it really exists, and I actually doubt that they've ever existed, right? Like, then like Balzac, for instance, is like it's sociology besides like fiction, right? You could make a very good argument that like Virginia Woolf is also like a psychologist, right? It's not a question of. We don't actually have to have jobs, right? Like, that's what's nice about art. It's that it's not a job. It's not like journalism is a job. But in Mexico, journalists also write fiction, right? And vice versa. So I don't know. I think that I think that that's just like the way it's always been. And we can just embrace it.
Yeah. I think maybe this thought that there are the divisions in the genres maybe in some way comes out of the history of MFA programs too.
Oh yeah, totally.
And yeah.
But the thing is, you know, but there are more things on heaven and earth that are dreamt of in American MFA programs.
Yeah,
that's nice,
absolutely.
Right? And it's like, well, I think like, you know, maybe my colleagues from other parts of the world will agree with me that it's just, you know, like American literature is wonderful. I love it. I read it all the time. I like review it. I embrace it. I am very happy to have had my literary education here. But also, you know, this is just one way of doing things, and there's other ways of doing things, and you know, that's okay. Like you can get a PhD, an MFA in playwriting, and then decide that you want to become an investigative reporter, and you know, they will probably inform one another. I don't know.
It's funny that you say this, and both you and Nicholas writing not in your mother tongue, right? So it's I've always been concerned by the fact that no matter how long I've spoken this language, English, I will never be able to express myself as fluently as eloquently as someone who was born and raised in either the United States or any English-speaking countries, and especially in terms of poetry, right? Because it's like so subtle, and every not only the words count, but also syllables and stress and rhythm, and you know. So I'm always preoccupied with the fact that I'm just not, you know, eloquent enough to write in English. I've tried, and you know, since I've been here, I've written two poems in English, and they seem to work because I've read them out loud, and you know, people received it pretty well. But it's just, it is not the same. I mean, I can't dedicate my time to learning how to write in English, but it's just, yeah, it's for me, it's like a completely different task. And so this is one thing. And the other thing, which I like 100% agree with, is genres not existing. So there are no genres. One of my favorite fiction writers, Sebald, you know, exactly. I mean, he was a poet too, because he has poetry books, but it is to me pure poetry what he does. Very detailed description of the landscape, of the environment, of the surroundings, of the environment. Very objective, you know, sometimes, which I love. I love objective poems, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's one, you know, transgression of genres. Another thing is like 20th century French philosophy, for example. If you read 20th century French philosophy, if you think of, I don't know, Derrida, or you think of Jean-Luc Nancy, or if you think of yeah, exactly, or Merleau-Ponty, or who, you know, so those texts. You know, being a teacher at one of Budapest's biggest universities, at the aesthetic department, I read and write some of these academic texts, and they inspire me a lot. So really, to be honest, I feel the most inspired when I read those texts, because these are, you know, smart people, and they use metaphors as well, right? So for example, Derrida's hedgehog metaphor, you know, it just really kind of hatched in my mind, you know, and it did become a poem later on, and so did other metaphors from other philosophers and thinkers. So and they are sometimes pretty hard to understand, and that's one of the reasons, because they sort of, you know, they kind of like they write poetry. So it's like it's so different from, like, for example, like 20th century German philosophy, which is like very on point, very direct, very, you know, and okay, not Heidegger, but but like, the beginning of
but Habermas is like technical writing.
Yes, and also like Husserl, where the whole thing comes from, where phenomenology originates from. You know, it's very on. I mean, he was a mathematician, right? So, I mean, Heidegger is different, but I'm highly inspired by these authors and the way they use metaphor and the way they recreate language, right? Because one of the tasks Heidegger decided to take was to renew the language of philosophy, right? So he used like all these new terms and used words in different contexts that, you know, hadn't been used like that before. So it is pure poetry, and he writes a lot about poetry, right? So, this is my answer. Thank you.
It's really interesting what's been said so far. I really liked a lot what Nicholas was saying about the genre being just like taken down. I feel that very, very strongly on so many levels. We were talking earlier, I had a reading with Maggie Sheffer earlier, and we were talking about how both of us came out of the speculative fiction tradition, and that used to be a border, like a big high wall when I was younger. And that, now it's like George Saunders is considered pretty mainstream, and who knows what he writes, but I definitely would call a lot of it, if you had to give it a name, I'd put it in that category. But many other people. So we are so glad to see those borders disappearing. The what's interesting to me and more subtle is the way that the border between fiction and nonfiction has been disappearing. In some of the ways he said, because a lot of the writing that I've really enjoyed, I mean, one example might be Kate Sambrino's novel Drifts, which I really liked, and I found it hypnotically readable. I mean, it's just, she's going about her day, but you follow her and you just kind of like enter into it. But one of the reasons why is because she includes you in so much of her thinking. So if she's reading something, if she's reading a philosopher, if she's seeing a movie, if she's really thinking about anything deeply, she takes you with her in her thoughts. So she's not writing criticism exactly, but you get her critical thoughts and her emotional experience of the works of art that she's encountering. And that's one of the things I really, really enjoyed about that book and others like it. In my own writing, the book I'm writing now combines fiction and nonfiction in a way that I actually lose track of which pieces are fiction and which pieces are nonfiction. It's not that I don't know which things actually happen, but when I write them, I used to always be very aware of writing a short story or writing a poem. That has disappeared. And that's really interesting to me. Another thing that was interesting just on a personal level is that both Maggie and I had the experience, we were the Iowa Short Fiction Award winners this year, and both of us felt absolutely no compunction about including a very significant nonfiction piece in the middle of our work of short fiction. And I think both of us wondered, well, what's going to happen when they find out, or something like that? Nothing's happened yet, but I guess I've given it all away. So, yeah, we'll see.
The question of genre and form. So I think back to when I started studying literature at university and how everything, was put into those buckets. Like, this is nonfiction. This is poetry. This is fiction. And we were taught to, I guess, identify the techniques or the characteristics of those forms so that we could be good readers. And I think as a Chinese New Zealand writer and as a queer writer, I was, without knowing it, wanting something that didn't adhere to those rules. So I was constantly looking for things that blurred the boundaries or tested the limits of those forms in ways that, I guess, allowed me to read about experiences that don't fit the norm or allowed me to express my experiences in a new way. And we were just talking, I was just talking to some friends last night about Maggie Nelson and, you know, introducing her to one of the writers on the IWP and explaining, you know, this is what's so great about Bluets or the Argonauts. Like, it's not quite poetry, it's not quite essays, it's, you know, there's a little bit of art writing, there's philosophy in it, and it's this amalgamation that makes it so exciting to read. Not just, you know, the text and the content itself, but as an experience as well, because you never quite know what part of the brain you need to sort of switch on to be able to fully engage with the text. And as you were sort of asking your question, it sort of actually made me realize when I started out writing poetry, I wasn't actually inspired by other poets or other poetry. As a teenager, I was reaching to pop music and to film, as a way of trying to find my language as a poet and or as a writer, and drawing from film techniques and comic books and things like that, because that's what I was interested in. That's what I wanted to take and turn into poetry. And I found myself almost reverting back to that state recently, because I want to write about joy. And when I think about, well, what is it that makes me happy? It's pop music, it's film. So my sort of canonical inspirational texts at the moment are classic pop albums. So I want to write about Britney Spears and Kylie Minogue and Madonna, because they are the formative texts for me. I love that as writers we can just ignore those boundaries of what is and isn't writing or literature and actually use that to our advantage.
In some genres, I think my concerns are more about art forms, mm-hmm. Including mm-hmm. writing as one of the art forms. So the reason why I mentioned that I sort of steer towards writing by artists is that I'm curious about why they have to write when they are already known by the world as a painter or an artist or musician already. Maybe they're also opening themselves to different art forms, but when that happens, would the painting come first or the writing come first? If the writing is secondary to the artwork, what kind of role does the writing play? What kind of thoughts that can be found in the writing but not in the art, or vice versa? What's the rhythm like, you know, in different art forms? Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like, you know, curious about things like that. So I'm particularly drawn to artists who work with texts or who write themselves, like, you know, maybe Jenny Holzer, Ronnie Horne, you know, Mel Potter, am I mispronouncing the last name? The one who do the blah, blah, blah? No. Anyway, who else? Cy Twombly.
You know,
there's a lot of people, you know, who work with text in their own work mm-hmm. as well. So I'm very drawn to that kind of cross-disciplinary mm-hmm. and, you know, think about, you know, what sort of role their writing plays, right? Because, you know, they are famous for their sculpture and painting. You know, they can be like billionaires already. Then why do they have to write?
Yeah.
Sorry, and just to add,
sure.
Don't you think of writing sometimes as sculpture? I mean, it is kind of like, because if you think about, you know, a poem and you're not, you don't necessarily want to convey meaning, right? Like a message or whatever. You want to kind of form the text. And to me, sometimes poems appear, you know, in three dimensions somehow. You know, like you see poems as raw material that you try to form. And so, again, something that is interdisciplinary and genre, and that I really do think of writing sometimes as sculpting, as something, because it's, you know, you never know what it's going to look like at the end. So you start somehow, you can start to chip off these little, you know, things, and then you receive the final form, which might be something you would have never expected.
Yeah, but to make a sculpture as a poet is very different from make a poem as a sculptor.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, interestingly, when you said sculpture, I, you know, suddenly think of one name. This is a sculptor called Hans Arp, A-R-P.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And his poems are all surrealistic.
Yeah.
It was wonderful, wonderful. And that simply becomes a kind of complementary materials to the sculpture done by him, which is very curvy, very fluid, you know, surreal at the same time.
Yeah, I think I understand about, you know, this, what are the different qualities within visual art that have a hard time translating to, to writing.
It's
or
abstraction, right?
Yeah.
So you have the abstraction in the work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And in language, you know, language is so much more direct.
Like referential.
Times. It's referential, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can, I think you can reach that point using language where you're not referential anymore, when you're auto-referential or a-referential, you know?
Gertrude Stein, maybe, yeah, who
exactly,
wanted to.
Exactly, yeah. Tender Buttons.
Yeah.
This is what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Well, I had one more question for you guys. I think we have enough time. It can be kind of it's sort of a quicker question, but it's for us here in the States, who don't often, I'm probably speaking for myself. Like I find out about international writers. I think Granta sometimes has some stuff. I know N+1 sometimes. What are the like venues or publishers, or where should we be looking for like really like exciting international writers?
Well, so N+1 certainly, but yeah. I'm gonna, like, you know, this is like a pet peeve of mine, and like I don't mean this in a hostile way at all, but like I think what needs to happen is that Americans need to learn other languages. You know, it's like the only country in the world where everybody's monolingual. Everywhere else in the world, people speak more than one language and read in other languages, right? Like my friend Haider, for instance, who is from Pakistan, speaks Punjabi, Hindi, Urdu, English, French, right? And you know, he's a genius, right? But like he tells me that in Lahore, like everybody speaks like three or four, right? In Mexico, like you have people, you know, it used to be the case, and it's becoming again the case, that like you had to like work, even if you were not indigenous, you had to know at least one indigenous language, otherwise you were not serious, right? And I think that, like, you know, Yeah, N+1 is a great place to find like a lot of Russian writing, a lot of Latin American writing. I think also there's a number of presses like Deep Vellum or like New Directions certainly. But it's just, you know, it's like sometimes like one has to like go out and look for things as opposed to have like, you know, things come to one. And I really think that like that begins with making the commitment to like learning a language, right? Because English is a wonderful language. I love it. I love it so much. I love it so much that I have continued to write it even though I no longer live here, right? I read in it all the time. But whenever I remember the statistic that only 3% of the books published in the United States are translated literature. That's, you know, a tragedy. But what's even more a tragedy is that like very few people in the United States like read actively in other languages, right? And I think like, you know, we have here like, you know, three people who are, at least three people, I don't know if like everybody, well, but for whom English is not the first language, right? And we all speak, I would like to say, pretty good English, right? But it would be nice if it was mutual, right? This was my eternal frustration. It was kind of like, I know so much about you guys, and you guys don't know anything about me. And like now that I live in Mexico, it's nice because it's, you know, we translate everything. Everybody translates, right? Like it's just kind of like almost like a public service of citizenship, right? Like we translate stuff from N+1 also. They translate stuff from us. You know, my colleague at the magazine where I work, for instance, like has translated a bunch of José Emilio Pacheco into French, and then somebody else in Mexico City translated into Arabic one of the novels. And when I was here as a student, I met a wonderful Algerian writer, Salah Badis, who works in Arabic. And he had read the Arabic translation of this novel, and he said, it was incredible because I had never thought that I would like be able to like feel so identified with the experiences of a Mexico City boy in the 1950s, and yet it moved me to tears. And it's just, you know, it's like, I think like that if people are interested in literature that is not written in English, one place to start is by like committing to learning a language that is not English well enough to read literature in it. It's, you know, it takes years, yeah. But you know, all of us learn English, right? You know, I don't know. Sorry, I really don't mean to be like, you know, mean or hostile, but it's this thing where of course, you know, in Rome, people from Rome didn't need to learn other languages other than Latin, and everybody else learned Latin. But Spanish is very easy. It's much easier than English. If you can conjugate the verb to be, you're gonna be able to learn Spanish, I promise you. Where is our what?
I'm having a hard time finding these venues and magazines and websites, actually. I mean, there are some, of course, but which I won't try to list now because but it is not easy. As a Hungarian poet, being, you know, part of the IWP crowd right now, it's basically no one speaks my language. and I had to work, really seriously with my translators to be able to produce as many poems in English as many I needed here. And it's actually not easy to publish either because not every magazine accepts poetry in translation. So again, the authorship counts, of course, but what's the difference between a good poem written in English and translated into English? I mean, authorship, obviously, but apart from that, there's not much difference. You know, it's a good poem in English. It is not easy. And as I learned here, again, being a poet, it's not easy to be seen because it's almost impossible. You know, for poets, basically, a literary agent does not exist. I mean, we don't, you know, sell as many copies. We don't produce as much profit, of course, and it basically does not exist unless you're really famous in some other ways, And yeah, so what I'm looking for right now are actually opportunities to publish my translated poetry in English. And so I keep looking for these places.
Well, I also don't know how to find much work in translation, so I'll let hopefully people who do know more about it answer it.
I'm not going to talk about translation, but just a sort of something that Nicholas said. You know, in New Zealand, we're so influenced by the US and the UK. So I think people read more UK and US authors than they do New Zealand authors. Mm-hmm. And it's just this constant battle to get people interested in writers from our own country. I think, you know, there's this cultural cringe that writers or books from New Zealand aren't good enough or they're not going to be worth your time, you know, but if it's a big international author, yeah, we're going to go jump straight to it, no matter how good or bad it is. You know, and this stems right from, you know, the very beginning of like having that lack of representation of New Zealand literature in our school curriculum and, you know, trying to get English teachers to include New Zealand texts so that people are actually reading them from a young age. So, you know, I feel like sometimes I live in a bit of a bubble when I think that people are reading New Zealand books in New Zealand, let alone New Zealand books in the world. But it's been wonderful to see some New Zealand poets and some New Zealand novelists actually get US publishers and you know, get a bit of attention here. So people like Hera Lindsay Bird, Nina Mingya Powles, Tay Tibble, and novelists like Pip Adam and Catherine Chidgey, and of course, Eleanor Catton. Baby steps, but if anyone is interested in New Zealand literature, I've got recommendations out the wazoo. But you know, we've got websites like Kete Books, which is K-E-T-E Books, which is a website dedicated to New Zealand reviews and criticism to try and encourage New Zealanders to read our own authors. And you know, the other benefit is that because it's online, international audiences can stumble across it. And yeah, if you visit that website in particular, there's a lot of curated reading lists of New Zealand authors, and that would be a one-stop shop to sort of find, you know, books that might interest you.
There are websites and magazines, you know, you can look up. So I'm thinking about websites. By which I mean like online literary journal, you know, you have Asymptote, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
They publish everyone. I mean, not everyone, but I mean like, you know, every language, almost every language and every culture. They have a very rich archive as well. Words Without Borders, this is the second one. Then what's the other one? Daryl, do you know the journal of Two Line Press?
Two Lines, yeah. The
online journal.
Yeah, yeah. It's called the. It's. I know what you're talking about. What's it called? For the Center for the Art of Translation.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Two Lines, no?
Yeah. That's, but the Two Lines is the name of a press, but they do also have a journal.
Right. Yeah. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
But I know what you're talking
about. So just Google, you know, Two Line Press. They put out very beautiful translations, fiction poems as well. You know, they're very cute, you know, book size as well. Wonderful, beautiful books. Circumference as well, of course, you know, the journal about translation. Oh. Circumference. They have print issues, and some of the contents are available for free online, so you can take a look at those contents. I think it's lucky to be in the States at some point, because you know, it's they do free shipping domestically. You know, imagine me being back in Hong Kong and want to read something by an Armenian author, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, the shipping would be huge, like, you know, $40, while the issue will only take like $12. So that's, but, you know, I'm sort of like over that already. Like, you know, I paid my money, just give me the stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, these are very good literary quality outlets, platforms you can, you know, take a look. You know, these are amazing people doing amazing work.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, very, very, very helpful and such a fun discussion. So thank you all. Maybe we can have a round of applause for our panelists.
There's like that joke that like you can tell whether someone
was a communist, is a Stalinist or not, because if they are Stalinist, they will clap for themselves. And if they are Trotskyite, they would just, you know, like, you know, it's the other way around. If they are Trotskyite, they will clap because it's, you know, everybody. But if it's a Stalinist, we're kind of like, yes. So you can decide which one we are.
Looks like they're not kicking us out. I thought I thought they would be. I don't know. Do you guys want to take questions or
yeah.
No?
Yeah, sure.
Are you done? Well, are we being kicked out or? Oh, okay. Well, maybe, I mean, if somebody has a burning question, yeah, yeah.
So one thing that I've loved about being here at the University of Iowa as a writing student is that we get introduced to a lot of different things that we've maybe never seen before and experienced in the writing. So I really had never played around with like hybrid writing before I got here. Didn't really know that was a thing that was publishable, I guess, until last year. I work at the University of Iowa Press, actually. We published some of hybrid writing things that are so beautiful. So I've been experimenting with that. But as writers, are any of you experiencing with anything right now that you're finding particularly inspiring or interesting?
The hybrid writing that I've had published has been accidental, and it's usually like I wrote a poem, a prose poem, quite a long one, sent it off to a journal. I was like, here's a poetry submission, and they came back and said, oh yeah, we'll publish this, but this is an essay, so we're going to publish it as an essay. So they just moved it into a different section of the journal. It's like, oh well, I guess I can add essayist to my bio now. But yeah, I think often you know, there's a lot of debate about what is considered hybrid writing or whether or not people can see, you know, what is happening in a text. And yeah, it's those conversations that I love having with readers and other writers about, like, what is the intent here and what is actually carried over to the reader. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, so I'm writing my second novel now. And one thing that I'm trying to do is to see if it's possible to kind of have like a third dimension of like a narrative arc, where one of the things that changes is not just the characters or like the tension of the events, but like, you know, the mode, so to speak, or the tone. And so like the novel that I'm trying to write begins and you start reading it and it sounds like out of fiction, and then it kind of gets weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder until it's completely deranged, right? And it ends in farce. And so I think like that's the kind of hybridity that I'm interested in right now. One where like it's not just that like a single part of the text includes elements from different kinds of writing, but like the mode of the text changes, and that's part of kind of like the progression of the narrative, right? This is something that I think, you know, like my namesake Nicolas, I have also like taken from film, right? I think like, you know, Godard, for instance, has movies that like begin in one way and end in something entirely different. And I think that that's something that I think is really cool, you know? But you're at the right place, you know? Like, the University of Iowa is a wonderful place to study writing, among other reasons, because, like, it's one of, like, the more internationalist corners of the American literary world, because, you know, they invite folks from the IWP. So, like, I think that, you know, go to all of their events. They know what's up, I think.
Yes, I think I constantly experiment with hybrid writing. Because I work for theater and I'm a poet and I write academic papers and they all inspire me and I realize that I, you know, they all basically form the texture of my writing, so I can't really even tell the difference. I constantly experiment with essay poems, for example. So that's like one thing I always do. It's a little bit different from like my regular poems, because it's more in tone. It's closer to academic papers, and but what I do sometimes is like I pick one of these, I don't know, like classical metaphors of philosophy, and then I kind of like derail, or so.
I would say ditto. My writing constantly takes texts. The book I just published uses philosophy texts of different kinds to make love stories. And so, I mean, sometimes as structures, sometimes as forms, sometimes as the language, lots of different ways. One of the most fun pieces I did in the last 2 years was about my mother, and I had two flash pieces that went together. And one was a nonfiction thing about her. One was a fiction thing about her. Interlaced, but not about exactly the same thing. But I was able to publish them together. This is the point. They didn't worry about whether, because I was like, well, is this fiction, is it nonfiction? How do I publish it? And they didn't even label it. So it didn't matter. I just put them both, part one, part two. One is fiction, one's nonfiction. And it was just published that way and no questions asked. So it's getting better. And yeah, it's a great thing to play with.
I'm currently working on a project that involves writing, co-writing and co-translating. Because I write in English, but then I have a Taiwanese friend translating my work into Chinese with me. And then I also translate his poem from Chinese into English. So we have this like dual working relationship. Now the project I'm working on is commissioned by a museum on two artists who masquerade themselves and take portraits of themselves. One of them is an American woman, the other is a Japanese artist. So the idea I have is to respond to the theme of masquerade through language, blurring the originality of a language. So the idea is to hopefully, when we finish writing, we'll have an English version, and then we'll have a Chinese version, and no one can tell which is the original language or the translated language. And the process is like, I start writing my poem in English and throw it to my friend, he will translate it into Chinese and keeps writing in Chinese and throw it back to me. And I will translate a new part back into English, you know, back and forth like that.
That is incredibly cool.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, conceptually, it sounds cool. It's but I realize that, you know, different people have different style and poetics, and you can really tell. And I'm not a very good translator, so, you know, I can't hide all the traces of translation. I'm still working on that, but it's, you know, coming to a close. You know, that's what I've been working, you know, in the Graduate Hotel. You know, I'm glad that I have something to work on, to be honest. So I think, you know, this is a kind of a hybrid in a way of making, rather than like how the text is arranged. You know, on the of course, that works as well. But I'm just, okay, yeah, let's do something fun, cross-cultural, you know, and...
process-oriented, right? Like hybridity, yeah, as process as opposed to like as genre, right? Like it becomes hybrid precisely because of the way that it's made.
Right.
Or assembled, as opposed to like, you know, yeah, I'm gonna write an essay that is kind of poetic. It's not like I'm gonna figure out a different way of writing, like actually use like the mechanics of it. I don't know. I think that's super cool. I can't wait.
And it's process oriented because nobody reads it anyways, you know.
Exactly.
No, but it's true. I mean, people are really scared of hybrid texts when they look at them and they don't know where to categorize them, you know. And I think it's you know, extremely fun to do stuff like that. Yeah. Sometimes it's just,
yes,
yeah, sometimes it's just like pretty tricky to get, you know, people read it, but yeah.
But you know what's even more tricky is that if the hypertext is read aloud as a performance in a gallery, then people go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, you know, how funny is that?
You can also just kind of like wear disguises, right? Like, you know, you can just like this. My first book, I disguised it as a novel, right? But it's actually like a weird history of Mexico, and it's just, you can just pretend that it's more accessible than it is. And then, you know, but the other thing that I will say is just, you know, Ezra Pound, the Testable Fellow, but you know, he did have I think like a really nice thing, which is kind of like a poet needs 30 readers, and yeah, I think it's right, you know, and you know, so yeah, nobody will read it. But like three people, it's like the Velvet Underground, right? Five people bought the record, but all of them started bands.
Yeah.
And much better to be the Velvet Underground than the Beatles.
Yeah, and what's even funnier is if you disguise your text as fiction, you can tell it.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, just like write a poetry book and say it's fiction.
Yeah, you know, like throw in like, you know, like a like the bare bones plot, and then, you know, kind of like, yeah, you know, it's a work of autofiction, you know, like you can just publish it, and it's kind of like, haha, and then you sneak in, you sort of like, you know, a bunch of stuff about like, you know, Baroque astrology in 17th century Mexico, and then people are like, what?
I think this sounds inspiring. I think we need like a cabaret with all the stuff. Yeah. Well, thank you guys again so much.